The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic, tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Seneca Podcast. You know the deal. We're produced in part of partnership with SubChina, which is the best way to get all the important news from China, whether you subscribe to our excellent SubChina Access newsletter or you just frequent the website. It is a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is, say it with me, reshaping the world. Woohoo! All right. Hello, New York. I am Kaiser Guo, and today I am turning my interviewer's gaze on my dear friend and co-host of the show. For many years, he's been Cheech to my Chong. He's been my partner in crime for a long time. I've made fun of him in hundreds of show openings. But that's only because I love him, of course. Today is a chance to find out what you've always wanted to know about this guy. So it was about 1997 or 98, I think, when I first met Jeremy. It may have been at a rock show I may have been playing. I'm thinking it's more likely it was at one of those clubs that, believe it or not, both Jeremy and I used to frequent in the late 90s. I think this place was called Club Vogue. Neither of us would be caught dead today in such a place, respectable middle-aged people that we are. Anyway, there he was, this skinny guy in a Jufro, and he would just be boogieing down. I mean, just like busting some seriously, I'm not kidding you, like amazing dance moves. I don't know if we could coax him into doing something for us here tonight. But, you know, really impressive, swear to God. And then out of nowhere, he would just suddenly launch into a backflip. I mean, he would, like, do a backflip. No injuries resulted to him or to anyone nearby. It was kind of amazing that he was able to pull this off. I actually thought that maybe my drink had been tampered with, and I wasn't sure that I had just witnessed what. But then I saw it happen again in various venues. And I knew that Jeremy was part of this crew, a very cool crew back then, which was this dominant expatriate English language magazine called the Beijing Scene, which was just great back in its day. Over the years, we got to be friends. We got to be, you know, partners in crime. We ended up as part of the same social circle, in part because, you know, expatriate life in Beijing was kind of small. It was kind of a huge city and a small town at the same time. And there were like five places where everybody went. Jeremy already had become something of a legend. He had this thing he would do, for example, on New Year's Eve, where at the stroke of midnight, he would strip down into his skivvies and then jump into Hohai Lake, like in the freezing cold Hohai Lake. And he did this, you know, on several years, including the millennium, where unfortunately I heard about it secondhand because I was down in Shanghai for whatever reason. But yeah, there he was. He was also somebody, though, whose perspectives and ideas struck me as quite original. He didn't simply map onto the politics of the world that I came from, or really onto the politics of the China that we both lived in at the time. You know, he would occasionally bust out an interesting phrase of Latin, which he'd most of the time have to explain to me. He had Latin, as they say. I took a real shine to the guy. One evening, I was at home with my then girlfriend, who was this kind of hard-ass Wall Street Journal reporter, really like a tough-as-nails woman, a really great reporter, really brilliant woman. And I said to her, I told her I was enthusing, as I am wont to do, about this friend of mine, Jeremy. And I said, you know, you really ought to talk to the guy, maybe have lunch. You guys would really hit it off. He's really brilliant. He's got, you know, really original ideas. And she just sort of rolled her eyes as far back and let out this exasperated sigh and said, Kaiser, I don't have time for your surfer, backpacker, South African friends. But I persisted, and she eventually did have lunch with him and came back and admitted that I had been completely right, that she was then a Jeremy fan. She didn't have time for him. I have plenty of time for him, right? And I think all of us do too. Let's bring him up on stage right now, and everyone give a warm welcome to Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy.
Oh. All right, so you're determined to make me a schmaltzy American, huh?
It's working.
Slowly.
Okay, so we've heard you on the show talking about how you were sort of this recent college graduate from Johannesburg, South Africa, and that, you know, he decided that he just wanted to get the hell out of there, and he went as far away as he possibly could. So, but something must have drawn you, Jeremy, to China. Something also must have made you want to stay. What got its hooks into you finally about China?
Well, I think I just wanted to get as far away from home as possible, you know, in every sense of the word, physically and culturally, and China met that. It took me a little while to actually like China. I didn't like it at all the first year I was there, but I was frustrated by not being able to understand what was going on around me, and so I wanted to stay. And then that sort of obsession of trying to understand what was going on around me just kept me there, because I kept on not understanding. And to this day, I still seek to understand China. I mean, I think that's part of what keeps me interested in it.
Right. One mystery, I don't think I've ever asked you this directly, because I don't know the answer to it, is how did you learn Chinese? Because I don't recall you ever having enrolled in some formal coursework. Did you sort of absorb it osmotically? Was it just sort of in the air? Because now you can read these. I've never seen you write more than a few sentences, but I know that you can read.
Well, the first year I was there, the job that brought me to China, I was teaching English, not at a school, but at a factory owned by ABB, a big Swedish engineering firm. And the idea was I was supposed to teach it was a joint venture, and the middle managers were all guys in their 50s who couldn't speak any English, and they had to interact with the Finnish general manager and production manager. And I was supposed to teach them English, and none of them learned English by the end of the year. I was actually accommodated not in a nice apartment, but in the workers' dormitory of the Beijing Jingji Jishu Kaifachu, the Beijing Economic Technological Development Zone, which was at that point outside what is now the Fourth Ring Road, but at that point it was countryside with farmers and fields. And there were like a few factories and a workers' dormitory, and me and about 100 guys from Anhui and Henan. And I spent the year, they were my friends for that year. So by the end of that year, I could speak really crude and very strange sounding Chinese, but I could make myself clear.
So that's why your tone suck, is because it was from Henanese people, right?
That is my excuse,
right,
anyway.
Okay, all right. Let us all not make fun of my country, my co-provincials, the Hunanese. They get it bad enough, so we don't need to ladle it on here. At one point, did you do that epic bike ride, though? I mean, I've heard you talk about it before. You biked through Xinjiang and in into Pakistan, right? And then all the way into Afghanistan, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I worked as an English teacher, and then I had this corporate training job with ABB for another year and a half. So and I saved up all the money I saved up. And then I kind of needed a break from China. I flew to Pakistan and I rode a bike to the Khyber Pass, the Afghan border area, and then up the Karakoram Highway into Xinjiang and around.
Oh, so you went west to east. Okay.
Yeah, I went back to Beijing. I was intending originally to go back to Beijing, but after messing around Xinjiang for 3 months and Qinghai and Tibet for 3 months, I decided to go downhill to Kathmandu. So I ended in Kathmandu, and the whole thing took about a year.
Oh, wow. What year was that?
That was 97.
Okay,
97.
So presumably then in the Khyber Pass, the Taliban was already quite active in that region.
Well, I guess they were. I mean, in Peshawar is the Pakistani city on the Pakistani side,
right,
of the border. And there was this guy named Baba who was running tours into what they call the tribal areas, which is, I mean, they're technically part of Pakistan, but the Pakistan government has never actually had control over them. And they're run by Pashtun tribesmen, basically.
Right.
So Baba took me into this to see some of his friends, and they were sitting around on the floor of this, you know, building of this little room with nails in the walls, and there were guns hanging off the walls. And we drank Jack Daniels and smoked opium and then went and shot their guns.
That's always a safe combination. Do not try this at home, kids.
I mean, these were more innocent days, because at some point I was, you know, quite stoned and high, and they started to ask me what religion I was. And I'd be advised in Pakistan that it was okay you know, to be somebody of an Abrahamic faith, you're people of the book if you're Christian, Jewish, or Muslim. But it wasn't okay to be an atheist. So I said, I'm Jewish. And they were like, what? And then I said, Jewish. And they were, what? And then one of them said, ah, Yehud. And then the whole room was going, Yehud, Yehud, Yehud. And it's, at that point, I sobered up. And I thought, oh, dear, something's going to go wrong. But then we just drank some more Jack Daniels. So it was a very different time, both in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and also, of course, in Xinjiang.
Right. Wow. Yeah, yeah. So here's something that's puzzled me for a long time. For your entire working life, with very few exceptions that I can think of, basically what you've done is you've created English language content about China. You've done this in all sorts of various guises. I think at one point you worked for one of Hong Huang's ventures at this magazine called Red Egg, which was actually in Chinese, so that was the one departure from it. But the rest of the time, you've been doing English content about China for English reading audiences. But at every incarnation of this, you've complained at one point or another to me how there's this sort of hard ceiling of English speakers who are interested in content from China, and how frustrating it is and how difficult it is to make money, you with your deeply entrepreneurial streak. And yet, what is the definition of insanity when you do the same thing again and again and expect different results? Oh, no. What is wrong with you? No, I'm joking, because actually, as we can see just by the terrific attendance, that it is possible. There are a lot of people who are interested, especially now. But yeah, what is it that makes you want to do this? Because look, I always tell people about this, you know, chasm of understanding between China and the United States. I talk in quite earnest tones about how it's my mission in life to build bridges of understanding, and I really sincerely believe that. Jeremy, I've never heard you say anything like that. Maybe it's because you're deeply cynical, but why do you keep doing this?
Let me just preface that by saying, I think things have changed in terms of the cap on the listen and audience numbers, just because, you know, China is so integrated with the rest of the world. And in this particular country where we're currently having a fight with China, I think, you know, sad as it may be for many of our relationships, people, you know, here who may have deep ties across the Pacific that are feeling under pressure. But for the news business, it's not bad.
I see.
Maybe I am cynical. Okay. I don't know why I keep doing this. I mean, maybe I just don't know how to do anything else. I think the thing is that it's, first of all, it's very interesting, and China has never been well covered ever by European or American media. You know, not that there aren't journalists and writers and scholars who do great work, but if you just think of how much we know about every single city block on Manhattan compared to, you know, vast swathes of China, that there's no information at all in English, you know, both swathes physically, but also, you know, culturally or intellectually. So that's really interesting. I mean, I think the other thing that I've always enjoyed was that the China field is full of people who don't speak their mind. And I first got a taste of what fun it could be to just be honest when talking about China when we did Beijing Scene, which was started by this kind of naughty American guy. And we had a language column, I don't know if you remember it, called Comrade Language.
Oh, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, so, I mean, the idea behind Comrade Language was, at the time, and it hasn't changed that much, unfortunately, but it's changed a lot. The Chinese language textbooks were, like, really, really, really boring, the ones you could get, you know, in Beijing. You know, I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Gubo and Palanka, the two foreign students
yeah,
who would learn about the four modernizations, you know, and this was the lesson material. So the idea of Comrade Language was, you know, you give lessons. How do you end a conversation with a Beijing taxi driver? You know, when they ask, you know, as a foreigner, this was obviously all aimed at foreign residents of Beijing. How do you end the conversation as quickly as possible? You know, have you got a Chinese girlfriend? No, I'm gay. You know, so it would teach you that kind of vocabulary. and, you know, where are you from? Iceland, you know, Bingdao. And, you know, at that time, kind of no one knew where it was, which would also end the conversation. But it started, you know, that was a little provocative in a kind of fun way. You know, we did a guide to the vocabulary of drugs in, you know, and this was printed in Beijing. I mean, you couldn't do this thing these days. But anyway.
What were the other questions you always get asked? I mean, it's always like, Are Jews smarter than Chinese?
Yeah.
Or,
you know,
is that North Face jacket you're wearing, is that fake or is it real? How about, how much do you make?
Yeah.
How much money do you make? Right, right.
Those. But, you know, the same kind of feeling, I suppose it's just, you know, a lot of journalists maybe are driven by a need to stick it to the man. But in the field of China, everybody tiptoes around the issues so much of the time. And they're either tiptoeing around the issues because they're, you know, afraid of offending somebody, the Chinese or the Chinese Communist Party. Or sometimes they're not tiptoeing around the issues. They're not really talking the truth because they're overgeneralizing. And, you know, there's so much stuff to say that falls in between those that I find interesting.
Right.
You know, just being able to talk the truth about what's going on in China, but also be sympathetic to China at the same time, is something that, you know, for some reason pisses a lot of people off. But I think it's something we need to be able to do because, you know, right, certainly in this country right now, you know, we are in danger of, you know, demonizing all Chinese people, demonizing the country. And there's also a problem with, you know, something maybe you want to talk about later, you mentioned, but, you know, a generation of older sort of China watchers who are used to a way of talking about China where you're always kind of slightly tweaking the reality to not offend people. The literary translator Eric Abrahamson, I don't know if you remember, he wrote this essay about tweaking, about how a lot of people involved in Chinese cultural and political matters at meetings and at forums will just slightly tweak what they say to soften reality so as to make China somehow seem like a completely normal place in areas where it's not. And that's something I'd like to change.
Right. Now, nowadays, of course, there's the other kind of tweaking that we do, which is to add a little bit of sort of angry polemic into everything that we say, just so that we make sure the outrage is sufficient to meet the high standards.
Now we have that right? problem where China scholars and journalists do feel the need to, yeah, you have to condemn Xinjiang before you can talk about interest rate cuts.
Well, we do that. I mean, absolutely. Look, I want to take us back to when I was, gosh, what will you say? It was probably 2001 or 2002. I wrote an essay for, I had a column in the back page of one of these English language publications, first in the, what was it called? That's Beijing, and then in the Beijinger. The column was called Ich bin ein Beijinger. And I wrote one in 2002, I think it was, about how Beijing is kind of a black hole for smart slackers. And I may have had you in mind when I wrote that. But how it was that so many of us just sort of came there, just sort of gained a rudimentary grasp of the language, made some friends, and then we just sort of got stuck there. We were just good enough. I mean, look, the cost of living was as low as the bar was for the skills that you had to have to actually make a decent living. You had to have a rudimentary proficiency in the English language, and you could get a teaching job. It was easy to get a visa and keep, you know, making those yearly trips out to Japan or to Korea or to Vietnam or to Hong Kong to get it renewed, and then you were back, and you were just sort of living in...
You didn't even have to do that. You could call up John the visa man, and he'd take your passport to in Mongolia, and, you know, everything would come back fine.
So I mean, I'm curious. Back then, it was Beijing, China really was kind of a low-gravity planet. A lot of us landed there with just really kind of sorry sets of skills. I would include myself in that with no particular... But some of us... did make decent lives for ourselves. You were one of that crop of what I would call, I think I'm borrowing a phrase from Brendan O'Kane, our dear friend, feral sinologists. You were very feral. I mean, in fact, you learned Chinese from a bunch of workers in Anhui and Henan living in a dorm, right? That's as feral as it gets. And yet suddenly by about 2006 or 7, I was seeing you quoted in just about every piece that was written by any of the major newspapers, every time, especially if they would touch on the internet, which was the hot and sexy topic of the day. How did you create for yourself a kind of authority, and how did you become somebody who could be quoted without embarrassment by respectable journalists?
Well, I kept doing the same thing, I mean, I guess. And, you know, I just, you know, stuck around, you know, Woody Allen.
You were there long enough.
90% of success is showing up, you know, and everybody else flaked, I guess, all the more talented people. I mean, I worked for Beijing Scene as a managing editor.
Right.
And because of that, I got to understand how the, at that time, sort of, you know, emerging commercial media business worked in China. And I understood the lay of, you know, the land, the regulators, and who you had to get to know. And I understood how the business worked. And that enabled me to, you know, stay working in that business, either employed by other people or as an entrepreneur, because it was a specialized skill that was useful to people at the time.
You guys had some pretty close brushes, though. I mean, I think that the tax men showed up and you guys clambered out windows at various points.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Beijing Scene was getting shut down by the police all the time. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty bad. But
you didn't quite navigate it as well as maybe.
No. But you know, I don't think I ever worked for a company or magazine that got shut down by the police again after that. So,
but you did work for you did start one that got blocked by the authorities.
Sure,
and we'll talk about Dan Wei in a second. But let's stick with this. You know, Beijing in the late 90s and the early 2000s and this sort of black hole period. What's changed since then? Something has clearly changed. I look at some of the young people of more recent years who've lived in Beijing, and in terms of their professionalism, in terms of, I mean, they actually do know how to code, or, you know, they actually have advanced degrees in relevant fields. They speak much better Chinese than you and I ever did. It's a very different sort of a Beijing now. The bar is clearly much higher. They're competing against those same people. I mean, the Haigui, but not just Haigui returnees, but against a lot of people who were educated in China and speak perfectly good English and compete with them in terms of salary very, very well. What's changed, though, for you?
Well, I mean, that's definitely changed. Now, you know, in the 90s, early 2000s, there were very few Chinese people who knew much about many, you know, Western subjects, whether it was how to make a cocktail, how to put together a glossy fashion magazine and what should be in it, how to write a script for a movie, so, you know, how to do subtitles. So people like us got jobs doing that because nobody else knew how to do them. And right. We kind of had an idea, which was better than everyone else. Right. So that's right. Now the young Chinese kids are, you know, smarter and more talented and more qualified, and they understand China better than us. Those jobs and those opportunities are all gone. There is another difference. So it was actually, I mean, there was a barrier to entry to get to China because unless you already knew people there, you didn't know how easy it was to, like, skirt around the visa system. And it was very intimidating to come to this country.
That, right.
You know, especially if you didn't speak the language, there were far fewer opportunities to learn the language. You had to take the risk. I mean, for many years, the first few years I was in China after I left the workers' dormitory, I lived in I don't know if illegal is the right word, but, you know, Beijing still had, they were called shouwai, foreign affairs accommodation. And if you were a foreigner, you were supposed to stay in those. You weren't actually allowed to stay in regular housing. Now, the police weren't really doing anything about it, but they would occasionally. I mean, I got booted out of Huajiadi. I don't know if you remember
that. I remember that. I used to, we were neighbors up there, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's changed. And I mean, China's so different. I mean, how can you compare?
Yeah.
You know, there were donkey carts on the Second Ring Road in 1995. And
yeah.
Now, you know, you can't cross it because there are too many Maseratis in your way.
Right? I drove for years there with no license and total impunity. I would get pulled over and just sort of wave a passport at them and pretend I didn't speak. I'd show them my American driver's license and say, Guojida. And then okay, I don't want to bother with this. I'm just going to let them go. it was a lot of fun back then. You're just like, I'm going to go see a movie. I'm going to park my car on the stairs of the movie theater. Why not?
You know, one has to admit that, you know, having a nice time in another person's country because the standard of living is low. I mean, it's kind of like looking back, I mean, the reasons we were having a good time was because all the Chinese people around us were living in horrible little, 70s, 80s apartments and making no money and hadn't traveled and hadn't been to college abroad. Now that that's changed, you know, the situation is different for foreigners, too.
Are we humbled or are we just angry? I mean, are the foreigners who are there now?
I mean, of course I'm going to say I'm humbled. I would never get angry about that. But I think there are people who are resented. I mean, there was this wave of letters around the time we left China written by sort of relatively prominent expatriates about why I'm leaving China. And many of them I felt were kind of whiny. They were like, I'm not special anymore, you know. I used to get appointments with the, you know, vice minister, and now his doorman won't even acknowledge me. I mean, you know, it was that kind of whining.
Yeah, I remember I was interviewed by a radio magazine in the United States once, and a part of it, they didn't end up using it. They used it as a show bumper, but I was walking around in the garage of the building that I lived in, and just sort of, he was asking me to name the makes and models of the various cars. And I was like, well, that's an Audi A8. It's a row of three Audi A6s. There's a Maserati. That's a Lamborghini. And, okay, what about your vehicle? Yeah, this is my electric bike I bought for 1,800 RMB, and they let me park it here, which is kind of nice. But no, I mean, that was emblematic of what things had changed. Like, suddenly all of our friends were much richer than us, and yeah, they had, yeah, that was definitely humbling. But how do some of us have gone on and actually stayed attached to China? That is, like, we continue to do work that's really relevant, to go back quite a bit. I don't think that we wasted our time there. In other words, just sort of slacking there. Because, I mean, I think that's part of what's good about you, is that you sort of know China at a kind of 接地气 level, at a, you know, close to the ground, right? I would say about you. Yeah.
Okay,
you'll take that.
I'll take that.
No, I mean, maybe you can expand on that. I mean, do you think that was an advantage that maybe we have?
I mean, we had a great opportunity to do a lot of different, really amazing things in a time when, you know, China was allowing
undeserving schmucks like us to.
Well, no. It wasn't just foreigners. I mean, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s, the government was pretty hands off about a lot of things.
Yeah, that's very true.
And, you know, because it was really it was when the economy was growing the fastest, and it was the lead up to the Olympics, there was this extraordinary sense of excitement that was just like a drug. I mean, I remember leaving China like for holidays and stuff, and, you know, starting to miss it. And then I'd get back to the Beijing airport and I'd smell that like stinky, polluted Beijing air. I'd be like, yes, I'm back.
I know the feeling well. Yeah. It's like, I can't taste the air here in America. It's no fun.
Yeah, there's no economic progress. There's no pollution. Take me home.
Right. Those were thrilling days. I remember telling people, you know, Beijing is a truly awful place to live, but there's nowhere in the world I would rather be. This
yeah,
is just on,
yeah.
on the
yeah,
eve of the Olympics.
It's the anti-lifestyle capital of the world, I think I used to say.
That's a good one. I should borrow that. But the arc of your relationship with China has been an interesting one to watch. Shortly before you left, in early 2015, if I'm not mistaken, you had gotten pretty bitter. I think it's fair to say. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fate of the website that you had run for a very long time. And so maybe let's start with that. Let's talk about the thing that maybe to this day you're best known for, or you were at least up until SubChina, which was Dan Wei. Danwei.org originally, and then Danwei.com. Danwei.org was, if for those of you who remember it, we started in 2002, is that correct?
2003. October 24th.
Right. So, oh, wow. Very good. And Danwei was really the go-to English language blog on China. It was more than a blog from the very beginning, wasn't it? What was the idea behind Danwei?
The sort of proximate cause of me starting it was I had sort of left the magazine and media business to start a design firm with a couple of friends. And I was working as a partner in the startup design firm, working for clients. And I had thought that, you know, this was great because I could use similar skills as media, except it'll actually make money and maybe the government won't shut it down. You know, this was a novel idea. But I found it very difficult to do that kind of work because, you know,
because it's client services, and that's just a miserable existence.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. I'm just not very well. I'm not tactful enough to, or I can be very tactful for, you know, a little
very
while.
Very short periods
of
time.
I lose my temper and it's no good. So I was very frustrated. And then I started reading a lot of American political blogs. It was, you know, after 9/11. And there was this extraordinary ferment of sort of discussion, political discussion in the United States, much of it about the Iraq War, both, you know, anti and pro sides were very, very active, and they were all using this blogging technology. And I suddenly realized all it was suddenly it was super easy to make a website. Whereas up until then, I mean, you had to still get past, you had to at least know how to do HTML. You know, you had to know some stuff to put together a website. Suddenly you didn't have to know very much stuff at all. And I thought, oh, great, now I can start a media company again, and it's not going to cost me a penny. You know, there's no printing fees, and the software is free. And so I just really started it as a hobby, and I wanted to keep my sort of hand in the Chinese media. So I started following the Chinese media industry and writing about it and then translating from the Chinese media. And 2003 was a really special year for media in China. It was really, in some ways, the height of the sort of freedom of the press as much as it has been in all the time that, you know, I've known China since 1995. That was the year that the Nanfang Zhoumo, the Southern Weekend, did its famous expose of Sun Zhigang, the guy who was killed in police.
The migrant worker who was killed in police custody.
And, you know, this article actually, you know, led to regulatory changes. And there was this extraordinary optimism amongst my Chinese friends who were journalists that things were opening up, and there
this is post SARS. This is, you know, now we're already in the Hu Jintao and Wu Jiabao era.
The Olympics are coming up, so a lot of people are hopeful about that. You know, and it wasn't just media. I mean, many aspects of civil society. It looked like the government was going to tolerate an expansion. You know, NGOs, a big one, rights lawyers. I mean, this was the height of the rights lawyers from 2003 to about, you know, 2000.
So, yeah,
it was six. I mean, I think everything. You know, the win. Ming Banwang, the civilized internet campaign, started in 2006, and one of the best known interviewees I interviewed that year, Muzume, the sex blogger, she said, you know, it's all over. And she was kind of right.
Well, it lived out for another decade, though.
Yeah.
But, I mean, or almost another.
But, you know, 2006, I think if you were observant, you would have seen that this wasn't going to last.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Ah, right, right. So what was the fate then of Danway? I mean, because what you were doing, too, I think it was just a terrific service. Not only did you have really good feature writing by quite a few quite prominent observers of China, but you also did these, you would look at, you do comparisons of the covers of major Chinese newspapers during the day, and then very valuable translations of some of the important stories from them. It was a terrific service. Well, you guys were getting 30,000 page views a day sometimes, and doing very, very well. And you
made videos too.
You made, yeah. So yeah, two of the things that I don't know if you remember. I mean, you can still find these things on YouTube, and I heartily encourage you to check them out.
No,
if you
don't.
No, do. Jeremy used to do this series, which I actually think of as sort of the bridge between what Jeremy was doing with Danway. And when we started Seneca, it was sort of the thing in between. It was these hard hat shows. He would put on one of these yellow construction hats, and he would sit in and do these sort of man on the street interviews, or he'd say, you know, I'm Jeremy Goldcorn, and I'm here. I'm sorry, I didn't butcher your accent, but it was very funny. I mean, you should check them out. They're very good. Terrific soundtrack to them.
And
really great kind of punky kind of driving guitar riff thing. And then the other was and Sophie Loewenberg and you did this series called Sexy Beijing. Check these out. They're really very, very funny. It's about this sort of, can you describe a Jewish woman?
I mean, Sophie is kind of like a neurotic LA Jewish lady.
Right.
One of my best friends. With these kind of
Lisa Loeb glasses.
She does look a little bit like, what's her name, Jessica Schumacher, the Sex and the City actress.
Sure. Sarah.
At least her friends, her Chinese friends often used to say that to her. So the shtick was, it was kind of like a parody of Sex and the City, and she'd be like, you know, I wonder, will I ever find a Chinese boyfriend? And, you know, then she'd go around asking kind of embarrassing questions to like old Chinese people, like, how did you meet your husband and were you in love? And they'd say things like, no, our parents chose us for us. Love, what are you talking about? You know? She'd get very interesting responses out of people. And it was a very fun, approachable way to sort of learn about China. So
I thought it was terrific. I mean, we should think about resurrecting something like that. I think that'd be a lot of fun for South China. Anyway, but you left, like I said, you left... Tell me about Dan Wei getting blocked. When did that happen, and what were the circumstances of it? Do you know what you did to trigger it?
Or? Yeah, I don't know what I did to trigger it. I do know that I was trying to sell it to The Guardian at that point, and so that was 2009 in the summer. July. It was 2 days before the riots in Urumqi. It was July the 2nd. I don't know what I'd done before that, but I was all excited. I was talking to the Guardian newspaper about selling it to them. They had a ton of money at that point. It was before they lost all their money in the financial crisis. And everything was great in my life. And I had this great new girlfriend who's now my wife. And we decided to go on holiday to Italy to meet my parents in Umbria. And, you know, I was the happiest man in the universe. And I get to Italy, and, you know, we're sitting in Umbria, and like overlooking some beautiful, you know, vineyard or something. And I get a text message from my colleague Joel in Beijing: the site is blocked. And anyway, then the financial crisis, no Guardian sale, and you know, I had up until that point actually believed that I could make a sort of media business out of it that would be either rely on subscriptions or advertising, and that somehow I was going to be let alone to get away with it in China, because clearly looking back, I was totally crazy. You know, if I saw someone in that situation today, I'd say, go get your head read, mate, you know. But suddenly I realized that no, that wasn't the case. And then I got back to Beijing and I had to figure out what to do with my life, that my baby had just basically been not killed but asphyxiated. So we started, we'd always done, like, you know, the site never really made money. So we'd always done other things to make money. We sometimes had job ads, you know, things would pay, but the actual bread on the table never came from the media operation. We did things like, you know, creative financing techniques, I suppose you could call them.
Live shows, maybe.
Well, we did some live shows, yeah. I mean, the thing that really kept the business going, to be honest, was, you know, one of these wonderful things about China in the 90s and the 2000s was to run a legal business, to take payment in China, you need something called a fa piao, you know, a tax receipt. And if you do work as a subcontractor, you know, a freelancer, whatever, for any company, if they want to write that expense off, you know, against tax, they have to produce a fa piao. And at the time, with all these slackers that you were mentioning in Beijing, these kind of foreign slackers, and then increasing numbers of Chinese slackers, none of them were like entrepreneurial enough to get their own company, and they needed fa piaos to, you know, charge companies for their photography or their video work or, you know, advertising copywriting. And I had the fa piao. So I would come to this arrangement where I would process the fa piao for them, and I'd take 12%, and I'd give them I would say, I can do it, but it's going to take 3 months or 6 months to pay. So basically, that was how I financed Dunway
for
most of its life. But the one thing that did actually make real money was research work. And so after it was blocked, we focused on that.
Right. And you eventually sold it to the Financial Times.
Yes.
Right. And that happened in 2012 or 13, is that right?
13.
2013. But during that time, I'd say after Dan Wei was blocked, there was a noticeable change in your attitudes about the Chinese Communist Party, about China sort of more generally. At least I thought so. And that was around the time that we were thinking of, we started Seneca in 2010. And there was already very quickly kind of dynamic between the two of us. I was the one who was sort of sunnier and always trying to, you know, glass half full. You were always sort of the more, and none of that was really that performed either, right? What happened to you? Do you think a lot of that was just sort of your own personal experience with Dan Wei? Because, you know, what strikes me as very odd is that when you leave China, it's in a period where China is clearly on a pretty dark trajectory, and suddenly Jeremy, living in sunny Nashville, Tennessee, is kind of, we almost would switch places, I felt like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, personal experience obviously has a lot to do with one's okay. attitudes. Having my website blocked was, you know,
but you galling. And everybody, right? I mean,
yes, but it was me.
Okay.
I don't know, I mean,
right.
You know, sure, that had something to do with it. I mean, I think the worsening, I mean, you know, there were other things, like, you know, one of the things I really loved over the last, you know, few years of the first decade of the 21st century was the China Blogger Conferences, which are these amazing gatherings of, like, you know, kind of tech nerds, and they ended up being this extraordinary combination of, like, geeks and nerds and software people and human rights lawyers and, you know,
activists of all sorts.
Yeah. You know,
and environmentalists and feminists, you know, and yeah.
And I mean, that was at its height in 2008 in Guangzhou, and there were secret police there filming us and everything, but, you know, they let us do the thing. The next year they couldn't get permission to do it anywhere except a place called Lianzhou, which is in the far west of Guangzhou, and it was literally in a cave. It happened to be a cave that the local guy who was a buddy with one of the organizers was in charge of the tourism department and wanted some publicity, which is why he agreed to do this.
Presumably they wired it up with Wi-Fi too, otherwise, I mean, it was a damn cave. I mean,
yeah, yeah. But, you know, after that, I just remember seeing many of those activists and lawyers being picked off one by one, you know, either silenced or disappeared and detained.
Or co-opted.
Yeah,
Isaac Mao ended up being like a rich venture capitalist.
Well, he always was. I mean, I won't say anything about Isaac Mao.
Great guy,
yeah. You know, but it wasn't just me. There were things started to seem that they were going, at least, you know, my friends and the things I was interested in were getting much more difficult to do, and really decent people I thought were being stopped from being doing really decent things, and I think the general political atmosphere you know did deteriorate.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it was that too.
Yeah,
I also honestly think I'd been living in Beijing for
20 years
at that point, and you know, I was getting to the point where, I don't know, you have to have a certain mental toughness to be happy in Beijing. You have to not let it bug you if you know, you're coming out of an elevator and all the people on the outside of the elevator rush in before the people inside are getting out. And I was becoming one of those kind of people who was like on a hair trigger, like temper, and I was worried one day, you know, somebody was going to push me in the elevator and I just like punch them or, you know, do something outrageous.
Well, it's good that you went out,
And that's when I thought, no, I've got to leave. So, I mean, I think some of it was personal and some of it was political.
Jeremy, I remember we were having a beer one day in Sanlitun in like 97, and I think I said to you, you know what I really like about this place is the slow pace of life.
It's hard
to believe how much it changed in that time. Look, you're somebody who's neither from the United States nor from China originally, but I would count you as quite a Sinophile and an Americophile. You've always enthused about the United States. You've all had a sort of special affection for it. But surely it must bother you a bit that so much of the focus, you know, not just here in the United States or in China, but so much of the focus on China is about China and its relationship with the United States. I mean, that takes such an outsized role.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it used to annoy me. It used to annoy me the way Americans always kind of assume your baseline for normalcy is an American.
Right.
You know? I still get asked this question. I mean, even speaking with my accent, when did you move back to America? You know, because that's just... But, you know, Chinese people and American people, I think, are very similar in this way. They, you know, they only really see their own country and the other big one.
No, that's true.
So I think, you know, the Chinese people taught me to be tolerant of American kind of self-centeredness.
I've often thought that the United States and China are more alike than almost any other two countries I'm aware of. They're the two countries in the world where people really go through life believing it's fine to speak just one language. They kind of have this, they harbor this fantasy that they are self-sufficient ultimately, that they can exist in isolation from the other and from the rest of the damn world. But I think they're also alike in good ways too. They both have this kind of basic belief in meritocracy that just sort of just grit and determination and is going to get you somewhere in life. And they're fundamentally decent and
hard
kind of
work,
nice
folk. Good work ethic.
Yeah, good work ethics. And, yeah. So yeah, I realize that.
I mean, the food, sadly, one can't compare, but that's changing in this country. So for the better.
No, it's changing very much in this country. I keep discovering these amazing Chinese restaurants. Anyway, it's one of the great things. It was one of the things that I think I worry most about with this new sort of McCarthyist crackdown. That will the restaurateurs flee? If that happens, then I might have to leave. it'll be just untenable here. What do you miss most then about Beijing? And not besides the food.
The food and the friends. Yeah,
right. Everyone says the food and friends. Right.
Aside from food and friends. I mean, I miss the sense of standing, you know, having like an observer's seat, you know, being able to watch history being made unfold in front of your face just about.
Right.
Somehow,
that front row seat,
you know,
was amazing.
Even, you know, Washington, D.C., you don't get the same feeling, and I don't know why that is. I mean, I think some of it's because perhaps the government is so in your face. So if there's a military parade, you know, you get an announcement saying don't go on your balcony for the next 2 weeks, you know? But it's
that's
exciting.
That's kind of like Washington now, right?
Yeah, I guess Washington is going that way.
What did Jim McGregor said? China is a place where every day you see something you don't see every day.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, the other thing, I guess, is the sort of can-do, like the speed at which people are willing to do things if they think they can make some money. Like, you know, you go into a store. I needed to buy a fridge the other day. And I go into the Lowe's, the store. They have a lot of fridges. There's a fridge. I choose the fridge. Oh, no, they don't have that one in stock. When can you deliver it?
3 weeks.
August the 7th. I'm like, what? You know, what are you talking about? You know, I really miss that. You know, I miss moving house in China, where in the morning I'd call up, you know, the like, you know,
Huaxia Banjia Gongsi.
Exactly, Huaxia Banjia Gongsi, the people who used to do the, you know, the Central Academy of Drama. I'd be
right.
Like, hey, I'm moving house at 2 p.m. today. Can you send a truck?
Sure.
It's like eight guys and a truck come at 2 p.m. Like, and then they
250 kwai. It's like, all right.
You know, I miss that.
Yeah, I do miss that too. That's
it's sort of Chinese can-do spirit. Americans have a can-do spirit, but it's different.
We had a tree fall on part of my house almost a year ago, and it's still not restored completely. It's just unbelievable how slow stuff gets done here. Yeah. It's just all these permits and all this. I mean, which is the truly bureaucratic state? I often wonder. Anyway, I did promise that we would get some questions from the audience. So maybe if anyone has something, walk up and speak into the mic. I'll hand you over. Anyone want to come up? Oh, here we go. Yeah, come on. Okay. It's our very own Shifra Parkin.
Hi, Jeremy. So I just had a question for you regarding the current generation of China watchers and how they're fundamentally different. And they've had a very different experience learning about China since like 2012 when the Xi Jinping rise kind of dramatically changed the tenor of how Beijing was interacting with foreigners. And I was just kind of curious if you have a perspective on the waves of China watchers themselves and how that's kind of evolved over time to a very interesting dynamic now where the young people are the hawks and the old people are the doves. And I'm just kind of curious if you have a perspective on that.
That's funny because that was exactly the question that I was going to ask you last. But
okay, well, I think there is a bit of a generation gap, and you know, like with many generation gaps discussed these days, as Generation X, I think we kind of sit in the middle, the poor, ignored Generation X that nobody's ever cared about, and maybe that's because we're just really the drag end of the boomers, and we haven't done anything for ourselves.
No, we are not like the boomers.
But, you know, aside from the broader generation gap that may exist, you know, between millennials and us. I do think there's been very different experiences. I mean, you know, the Beijing that we were waxing nostalgic about, I mean, that was a fun time to be in Beijing. You know, the last few years in Beijing, not only aren't you going to start a website, you know, in a fashion that I just described to you that, you know, is unconventional to say the least, and have a lot of fun doing it and not get into any serious trouble. But now, you know, there was, in fact, an example of this on Twitter the other day. Michael Swain, who signed the letter of scholars calling
China. He actually wrote the letter, really.
He wrote the letter, basically, you know, asking the U.S. government not to treat China like an enemy. He had a Twitter exchange with Elliot Zagman, a guy, a young, talented writer. He's written for us and writes, you know, for a lot of publications on China. And they were talking about this generation gap. And the example Elliot sort of brought up on Twitter, he said, well, for example, have you ever been in a legal establishment on a Saturday night when the police come in and make everybody urinate in a cup, you know, for a drug test? You know, so
fair point,
I mean,
yeah.
Younger people are experiencing a lot more of the harsh end of the Communist Party, you know, whereas compared to us, I mean, I had the same treatment driving.
Well, I've been detained many times, but...
Let go with a nothing, you know, not even a tap on the wrist, really. I mean, you know, well, you know, I don't know about you, but me, I never got into real trouble. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, you can get into real trouble now for things that, you know, would not have raised an eyelid 10 years ago, you know, for having the wrong visa and teaching English. People are, you know, getting sent to detention, administrative detention for two weeks. I think there's some of that. I think there is also the fact that, you know, through the 90s and the early parts of the 21st century, in the run-up to the Olympics and before the financial crisis, I mean, there was generally a lot more optimism about China in the United States and in Europe and its political course, that it was opening up and it did seem to be liberalizing. I mean, people put way too much hope on the Olympics. Of course, it was kind of ludicrous to think that, you know, after the Olympics, China would suddenly become a representative democracy or something. But that was kind of in the air. And so there was a lot of optimism. And, you know, the Chinese government were still running with it. You know, Zhu Rongji's reforms worked out. And they basically thought, we have here a recipe that's working. Let's go. And they didn't really micromanage in many things. So, I mean, that was just a lot of fun to be there.
Yeah.
From the financial crisis, the party got a lot more, you know, there was that swagger that we've talked about, or what you used to call the new truculence, where suddenly it seemed that at least the Communist Party was not interested in hearing anybody else's point of view. And since 2009, I mean, that from an outside perspective, I think has got worse and worse and worse. So you see these younger China scholars, I mean, they've never really had that sense of optimism, or at least it was crushed very quickly compared to older folks who've... On the other hand, older folks also remember, I mean, even what it was like in the 90s when, you know, you had to get your work unit's permission to get married. And, when you remember
how... You could get dragged out for cohabiting with a Chinese woman or something like
that. Yes, you could. You could get arrested for that. You could get arrested for being gay. I mean, you could get locked up in a mental asylum. I mean, there's so many areas that China's made progress that I think some of the youngsters don't really understand, whereas some of the older people, they have in some ways, a better perspective.
Yeah, it's a real trade-off.
I also do think, I mean, the things I was saying earlier about the need to, you know, speak the truth, I mean, I do think that a lot of the older China watchers have fallen into some fairly lazy habits of mind where there's a certain way of talking about China that can be very off-putting to the younger people because they think, like, you're not telling the truth, you know. I think one example, a very clear example of this, and we talked about this in that podcast with Michael, was the letter from the scholars. They didn't mention Xinjiang. And I mean, I think I fell in the younger person's camp of this, but I the reaction was almost uniform, I noticed, about those younger China watcher types who commented on it. They were like, why didn't you mention Xinjiang?
If you're going to lay out a litany of China's sins, that seems to be the biggest, and why ignore that? No, I would agree with you on that, for sure.
And I'm not saying who's wrong or right, but I think that's the difference in the generations. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You falling on the younger side of the divide, you have the right to tell me I'm a stupid old man and I don't know what I'm talking about.
All right. Let's take at least one more here. Anyone have one? In the back here. Come on up.
Oh, I'm Alexa. I'm a nursing student at Columbia. I really appreciate you guys sort of talking around your experience of moving from Beijing back to the U.S. or to the U.S. And I also just moved from Beijing 2 months ago, and I did basically all of my 20s there, all of my early 20s. So I guess my question is, what is your advice for sort of practical ways to make dividends on the China experience or continue to engage when, at least for me, my current sort of career outlook doesn't naturally go along with China watching?
It's a great question, Alexa. Jeremy, take a crack.
Well, if you're living in New York, I think, you know, you're lucky because there's so much going on. So, I mean, obviously, you should come to all our sub-China events and subscribe to our newsletter.
Well
including
done, sir.
Our paid newsletter.
Shameless and well done.
But I mean, I think that's you've got to stay engaged with the news. And whatever language you've got from your time there, you know, work
keep it
on
up.
It. Keep
yep.
it up. And New York has plenty of groups, Chinese-speaking groups. And, you know, thankfully, Chinese is now one of the languages of the city. You know, it really is. I mean, you cannot go anywhere in Brooklyn and Manhattan without hearing people speaking Mandarin. So I would say, you know, try and keep the language. That's really work on the language. Put a lot of attention into that. And then just stay on top of the news. I mean, I think maybe things, you know, I hope things are different in like 10 years' time. And there might start to be like deeper cooperation between U.S. and China. And I think the life sciences, medicine, you know, this is
one area of obvious
one area
yeah.
of optimism. So, I mean, I think you should keep your hand in it, in the game, if you can.
Absolutely. There are great resources like this, the Beijing Club of New York. They've got a very active group here. They turn out to our events pretty frequently. You should check them out. Yeah, New York is a really easy. I mean, it's much harder when you're in the middle of the country and there aren't those sorts of communities. But really anywhere on the West Coast or on the East Coast, it's not too hard to stay connected. Yes, come on up.
Hi, I'm Theo. I also came back from Beijing recently. I just wanted to ask if you could tell us a story about like any kind of experience you had where you felt like you kind of leveled up in terms of your understanding of China or Chinese culture?
Well, I mean,
leveled up is young people speak.
I can guess what it means.
Okay.
I mean, I think the first year that I described, that was the big level up because I went from zero understanding to, you know, being able to sort of communicate in the language and having an idea of what was going on. You know, I think the most important thing I did was travel a lot outside of the big cities, outside of Beijing and Shanghai especially. That really made a difference because if you stay in Beijing and Shanghai, you get a very, very like warped idea of what China's like. And the countryside and the smaller towns teach you a whole other thing. And they kind of teach you what's in some ways is really going on in the country because that's like the real stuff. That's where the future is, in a way.
You sound like an American Democrat after 2016. No, you're right. But it's for good and for bad, right? I mean, it's not just that everything is better in Beijing and
Shanghai. No, some things are worse.
Right, no, that's it.
You see dead bodies on the street in the countryside that people are just driving past and not picking up because nobody wants to get involved. You know, that kind of, you see the bad things too.
Right.
And then, of course, you meet these wonderful characters in the middle of nowhere who are smart and sophisticated, and you think, how did you learn to speak such good French in the middle of Guizhou?
Well, thank you, Jeremy, and thanks for everyone for coming. Let's hear it for our dear editor-in-chief, Jeremy Goldcorn.
Thank you. I hope I don't get fired after some of those confessions.
Is this job safe? Oh, okay. Confessions of an Opium Eater. Okay. That was a long time ago, and he has not repeated.
The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Cynical
Thanks
Network.
All for coming. Thanks,
Jeremy. Our show is
Thank
produced
you.
By Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McDonald. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Caixin Cynica Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, our two shows focused on women, E Voices and Ta for Ta, and the Middle Earth podcast on the culture industry in China. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care.